Welcome to The Virtual Shift, a show looking at the seismic changes happening in healthcare with virtual care at the epicenter. Join me and my guests as we look at key cultural and policy shifts impacting how providers, payers, and patients connect, as well as how care is being reimagined both for today and the future. Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Tom Foley. You can learn more about this show by visiting the program on healthcarenowradio.com, and be sure to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at Foley Tom, and the hashtag, The Virtual Shift. We have a very special guest on the program today, Tom Campanella. He is the healthcare executive in residence at Baldwin Wallace University. Tom, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our talk.
Awesome. So you write some very interesting posts on LinkedIn, and I do follow them and read them. And I thought, geez, let's have a recorded conversation, because I think you and I think a bit alike and maybe a bit unlike, right? So it's always good to have those types of conversations, because that's where people learn the most, in my view, hearing different opinions and letting them decide. So the first post that I want to refer to is, the title of that post is, Are There Primary Care Physician Models That Work? Tell us a little bit about what you wrote in that model and what your conclusion was.
Well, first of all, what really set the stage for it, I was tired of hearing from so many different sources that the day of the private practice as relates to primary care is gone. Primary care physicians will be, no longer around in 5-10 years from now, given everything that's going on. Nurse practitioners, and even though I value them, will ultimately replace or nurses, primary care docs. All we need is specialists in hospitals. And I was saying, you know what? I think the public needs to have a better understanding that not only is primary care important and should not be neglected, and we need to invest in it, but also that there are successful models out there that can be cloned in other parts of the country. So I did some research. I definitely did a number of different meetings virtually and others with different organizations throughout the country. Some of them were primary care practices, in this case, within our region of Ohio, and interviewed them to come up with my thoughts as to not only identifying the ones that work, but why they work. What is the difference between a primary care model that works and the ones that fail, or the ones that don't provide the value necessarily for the patient?
Do you see a distinction in the primary care model in context of fee-for-service versus risk-oriented reimbursement models?
Definitely. And in fact, the key is, there's a little phrase that I use, Tom, is a healthcare system is shaped by what you pay for, and most importantly, how you pay for it. And when you think about it, the what you pay for part, for an example, preventative medicine, if you don't pay for it, well, guess what? You're not going to get it provided. But the important part is the how you pay for it. And currently, you know, from a listener standpoint, what we currently have and have had historically for 40, 50 years is the fee-for-service model, which is basically the more you do, you get paid. So the more services you provide, the more money you make. So it really accelerates and is really the fuel, bluntly, for the growth of hospitals and even specialists, because there's the more they can do, more specialists, more surgeries, procedures and that. On the other hand, the real value of primary care, when you think about it, is keeping people healthy. And so the way, and we attempt to pay primary care docs through fee for service, and that doesn't work. So the one thing I discovered is the how you pay part was a real key to the real successful primary care practices out there throughout the country.
So the challenge here is, well, there's a couple of questions that I have on that front. Value-based care requires a different model. It's not just a new reimbursement model, but what it does require is a different depth of patient engagement when the patient is not in the brick and mortar. Is there a pathway that you see from a primary care provider in a fee-for-service model on how do they get to value and then have the risk mitigated in the context of experience in having provided that under a fee-for-service?
Well, first of all, it's actually quite challenging because both in private practice, but also in integrated systems with, you know, that are hospitals and the primary care docs owned by the hospital, the focus is let's see as many patients as possible. And because the fee for service, you got to make as much money as possible, see as much many as patients as possible. And then, especially as it relates to employed primary care docs in hospital settings, so many hospitals are then, you know, from a fee for service saying where we really make money is having those patients see specialists. So the next thing you know, they're going from the primary care doc to the specialist. So the bottom line is the primary care doc, family medicine, spends little, very minimal time with the patient. They don't really establish a relationship. And then going back to where you're coming from too, a key to, you know, keeping people healthy is engaging the patient in their own health. And you're not really in a position, you don't have the time, the model isn't set up to sort of engaging and getting the patient more involved in their own care. Because where that comes through is education, where that comes through is having a trusted relationship with your primary care doc. So it becomes way too incremental. That's why you really ideally need to have a different way you pay for primary care.
So I was asking that question because, as you allude to it, and I'll just say it differently, you know, that physician is on that cycle every day, right? It's you know, the 10-minute average visits. It's slightly different than 10 minutes, but you understand what I'm saying. There's that, you know, 10 minutes, next exam room, and they spend, you know, 3 hours at night doing all the charts, right? They have very little time to be strategic, and they have even less time to do that patient engagement. I come at it, as you know, I have a virtual care background. So I'm always thinking about how does a provider extend the delivery of care into the home, a primary care provider. And the point there being is when you talk about value, we often hear about medication adherence is a value prop. Reduced emergency room visits is a value prop. Reduced hospitalizations. There are all ways in which a value-based care model becomes successful because they're reducing costs and improving care. Well, value-based care through remote patient monitoring and chronic care management can do the same thing, right? It increases patient engagement in a primary care model under a fee-for-service. I can achieve those same measures, right, and actually make some dollars on it. Now, that primary care physician is going to have to entrust a care management team that they may not have, but there needs to be trust instilled. And those care managers are the ones that are ultimately going to do the patient engagement on a day-to-day basis in order to achieve the successes of the care plan, right? And the outcomes of that is typically enhanced medication adherence, reduced hospitalization, reduced ER visits. So in some contexts, there's some similarities. And I always say that the primary care physician, if they were to embrace virtual care models like RPM and CCM, they could get the experience on how to provide value as opposed to the leapfrogging into a risk-oriented contract, right? I've never done it. I haven't, you know, so it's much more risky, if you will, to kind of make leapfrogs without having without a previously defined path of experience. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a couple things. First of all, there is no one size fits all. I mean, when it comes down to, I'm a believer in competition. Number two, I'm a believer in innovation in that. And obviously, the whole focus on virtual has a core to it is innovation, and it's evolving. And so I'm a believer in it. I think what needs to be done is the sort of connection point. So for an example, I can see where the virtual part with a primary care brick and mortar practice can be definitely an add-on where you have patient visits. And now all of a sudden the patient goes back home in the home setting. And 9 out of 10 times, they don't even remember, especially if it's an older patient, exactly what the doctor even told them. And then a family member would say, okay, what are you supposed to be doing? Did they talk to you about your drug adherence or whatever? And they're saying, well, I can't quite remember. Well, I think there needs to be follow-ups virtually, and it doesn't necessarily need to be the doctor, the care teams and that after the patient visit. But keeping that, still that in-person thing on a periodic basis. And then as part of that, there could be different ways to engage the patient from an understanding standpoint, including providing them links or videos or whatever it is relating to their particular health issue, diabetes or whatever, how better to be able to address it in a very common sense, user-friendly way. So I definitely think there is a role for that, from that standpoint. I think my only concern when it's strictly virtual, bluntly, is the patient relationship and trust part of it all. If there is a different group of people every time the patient links in to someone else, and there's a different either doctor or care team or whatever they're dealing with, they sort of lose that, trust, that comfort feeling. There may be different, messages being told and that. So that continuity, I think, is an important part. And, so in the best way, I would love to see more of a combination of the two. The other part of it is I've written a number of articles on care in the home setting. In fact, I wrote it a couple articles prior to COVID, and I call it the new frontier of healthcare. Because, ultimately, people are gravitating and staying in the home setting at different points. As we get more care being transferred to the home setting because it's a much more cost-effective way, there's going to be advances in technology as well as medical device and others to allow you to both provide the care, monitor the care, and diagnose the care remotely, for an example. And all that fits into a virtual model for also primary care, too. So I definitely see that home setting being much more of a friendly place, and then you can have family members there or whatever. So I definitely think there's some opportunities there.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, and we're definitely on the same page. And so we have this fee-for-service model, and we have this value-based care model. And we alluded to some of these areas and where folks promote the greatest savings, right? But is either model enough? And the reason why I say that is, at the end of the day, while I might improve the efficiency and the of the delivery of care, I still am obese, and I'm still a diabetic, and I still have cardio problems. It seems to be like we're finding ways in which we're reducing costs, but we're not necessarily focused on the problem of the patient, and truly in the context of remission or cure, and it's more management. What are your thoughts?
Well, twofold. First of all, from a long-term perspective, you need to be in a position where you need to get to people at the right time, younger people in high school and stuff, nutrition, those types of things. Connecting and engaging people in their 20s and 30s, because bluntly, what you do in your 20s impact your 30s, what you do in your 30s impacts your 40s all the way up. The idea of it's like a car or anything else, if all of a sudden at 65 or 70, after eating, drinking, and obese, diabetes, all these heart issues and that, and say, okay, now I want to be engaged in my own health. It's going to be quite challenging, to say the least. So, in the ideal scenario, you're starting in, at a much younger age and really working with these people, in different areas to manage it. But once you have those health issues, then you're in a position, well, how best to handle it? You may not cure the particular health issue, but one, are you able to get them into the right setting? Two, again, are you able to engage them and family members to be a proactive participant, you know, making sure they're taking their medications appropriately. Going back to being a diabetic, if there's a difference between the diabetic that doesn't follow the medications, doesn't follow what they should be doing eating wise, and the next thing you know, they're in the emergency room, versus ones that able to monitor it, addressing obesity issues in food, trying to be able to do those things proactively. So there's definitely a difference in potential outcome and results. While it's not going away, you're better able to manage it.
Yeah, we agree. I have someone in mind who is actually a diabetic, and they utilize a pump. They went from being pre-diabetic to then, you know, diabetic, pricking the finger, CGM, and then now a pump on the hip. And I always get concerned because when they hypothetically eat that jelly donut, they're just adjusting the pump, right?
Yeah,
they're not adjusting the diet. To me, you got to adjust the diet. And I think this nation needs a more of a national Biggest Loser type of campaign, where wellness at the early ages, as you talked about, at the earliest as it possibly could be, to shift the mindset of the youth of the population, and also potentially shift the mindset of, you know, again, just because you're 55 or 60, 65 doesn't mean you can't lose weight. It might be a little harder, but they need coaching, but it's achievable, right? I'm on that journey myself right now.
You're so right. And in fact, I have my own personal story just real quickly and this would have been maybe almost 20 years ago, but, I was, you know, getting pretty heavy, and I would think I was like 215 pounds or something like that, and I'm about 5'11". And I was in a position where my doctor put me on statins, and, you know, because they were concerned about a heart attack or whatever. And, well, it turns out I was one of those rare persons that you read in the you read about when you're, or you see on TV, is from a side effect standpoint. I had a side effect related to statins that created some other health issues. Bottom line, I no longer can take statins. But I had high cholesterol. And so because I would no longer had that pill to manage it, I had to really do a drastic change in my lifestyle. I actually lost 50 pounds.
Great. Good for you.
And I've only gained back, and this was 20 years ago, I gained back maybe 12 of those 50 pounds, and I'm in pretty good condition, but I was forced to not just have a pill to sort of take care of everything. I had to really do a major lifestyle change, and I think in the long run, it's really worked. And plus, on a personal basis, I'm doing hiking vacations and everything else. I'm 74 years old, and I think I can enjoy my senior years a little bit more, because I was 20 years ago, I had this sort of moment that I had to make a decision on, do I do this, or, you know, do I have a heart attack, or do I change my lifestyle?
Wow. You look good for 74. Good job.
I'm feeling good.
Yeah, good. Good for you. Hey, let's spend the last 10 minutes of this conversation on another article or post that you did on LinkedIn. Fixing Medicare will also mean fixing Medicare Advantage. You make an interesting statement right off the bat on this, and you talk about, as you would expect in Washington, the debate over a whole metrics of potential fixes. Or so-called fixes. I know it doesn't say much in that sentence, but is the problem with healthcare an insurance problem in the way in which we pay for it? Or is it as you were just alluding to, is it the behaviors of every consumer out there? And where does the responsibility lie relative to how do we fix healthcare?
Well, one, it's a little bit of both. I'm not trying to get out of it, but there's no, as you would expect, silver bullet answer to be able to resolve it all. You definitely need patient involvement, patient ownership of their own health. You know, poor lifestyles, there's only so much you can do if you're a doctor, nurse, or anything else, if somebody continues to have the poor lifestyles that are impacting their particular health issues. at the same time, you know, and, you know, this could be a 3-hour discussion, and I don't think we have enough time for that. But I call Medicare the 800-pound gorilla because in many ways, Medicare has been the cause of and created in many ways the sick care system that we have. Because in effect, the majority of payments is, you know, to hospitals and others is all focused on after you get sick. So yes. The focus has never been keeping you healthy. And so the fuel for hospitals, again, and Medicare sets the stage for it, has been always the fee for service. The more you do, the more you make. The managed care companies, commercial insurance, have really sort of jumped on the bandwagon, and they've cloned Medicare from that standpoint. And you know, that's why when I tell people or talk to people that say, oh, we should have Medicare for all, I'm saying, you know, to them, you know, I said, wait a second, you know, you really, Medicare has been part of the real problem. And one of the big challenges, bluntly, Tom, is governmental programs. You know, I had daughters that lived in D.C. And, you know, the bottom line, the healthcare lobbying machine in D.C., focusing on Congress, the administration, CMS, is tremendous from all the big stakeholders. And this is, and it's, and everybody's in it. The American Hospital Association, the health insurance groups, pharma, everybody else. And they're all looking for their piece of the pie. And the end result is that's one of the reasons why Medicare is a fuel for 20% of our GDP being, you know, on healthcare. If we were focusing, going back to what you said before, keeping people healthy, then all of a sudden, some stakeholders, you know, aren't going to make as much money as they made before. And it would be a whole disruption of the industry. But guess what? We need to do that.
Yeah. Listen, you have close to 50% of the nation, 50% of the nation are in the obese category. Diabetes, we have more sicker patients today, whether it be diabetes, obesity, cardiology, respiratory, more people sick today than yesterday. Our system doesn't work in a fee-for-service model, and I don't think value-based care goes far enough because there's nobody focused on me. And helping me. So I think I hear you and what you said, but I think if we can shift the incentives more specifically to, hey, is your count on your number of obese people that are members in your program lesser tomorrow than it is today? Then you get paid. It's not just about, you know, if your glucose counts are stable or reduced somewhat in your overall population. Yeah, that's a good sign. But I still have diabetes. I still need to do some. I need a different approach. There's a study over in Ireland, a clinical study. 48% of the population, based on their digital therapeutic, population of diabetics or people with diabetes, went into remission after participating in this long program. That, to me, take the 50% of the U.S. population that are either diabetic or pre-diabetic and put them in that program. Imagine the cost reduction in the entire system. I know I might be thinking too pie in the sky, but the point there being is that there's a model that we're missing, and it's patient engagement. It's understanding the social determinants of health. It's encouraging behavioral changes. None of that happens in the brick and mortar facility.
No, it comes down to personal accountability. Yeah. And, you know, and it comes down to, and I couldn't agree more, and it's not just in healthcare, let's face it, it's across the board, you know, in regards to the old personal accountability. It's always somebody else's fault or whatever it happens to be. But I think it starts at an early age, too, going back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, in regards to grade school, high school, college, or whatever. And it needs to have a family focus even, you know, because if, you know, how many times, you know, from an obesity or other standpoint, you see, which really drives me crazy, 11-year-old or a 10-year-old that's obese, and then you take a look at mom and dad, and mom's making the meals, or they're going out to McDonald's or whatever it happens to be. And so it really is a family decision that they need to sort of find ways to work together from that standpoint.
Yeah, I real quick story, because we only have 2 minutes left. I was a wrestler in high school many moons ago. I started a wrestling program for kids from 5 to 13-year-old. And there was a young kid, friend of the family, actually very heavy, typical kids being bullies and things of that nature. So he was the bully. He was the one being bullied. But, you know, just pulling him aside. And, you know, when he got weighed in, nobody was in the room. So nobody could, you know what I mean? It was, but there was personal coaching too. Hey, let's do this. And by the time, you know, I'm not taking full credit because it was him that did it. But by the time he got to high school, he had a six pack and he was a stud. So, but people need to be encouraged and to take change. So we have a 1 minute left, and I'll give it to you relative to closing comment.
Well, again, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk here. Bottom line is we spend 20% of our gross domestic product on healthcare in the United States, much more than every other country. And the main focus of those dollars is really after people are sick. And we need to have, I call it a Marshall Plan, from, you know, World War II, as it relates to healthcare, a complete revolution in regards to it. And some of it, as we've been talking about, relates to the patient engagement and accountability, and also a strong focus on primary care, and ultimately changing us from a sick care system to a real health system. That's what's needed. That addresses your cost issue and everything else. It's really a win-win for everybody when that occurs.
Couldn't agree more, and we'll have to leave it there. Tom, thanks for participating in the program. Hopefully you'll come back soon.
Sounds great, Tom. Thank you.
That's today's shift. I appreciate the audience taking the time to tune in. If you missed part of today's episode, you can tune back in at thehealthcarenowradio.com at the same time, 11 a.m. or 7 p.m. Eastern throughout the week. And be sure to check out the program page at thevirtualshift.co. As well, remember to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter at Foley Tom, and follow the show's hashtag, The Virtual Shift. I'm Tom Foley. Until the next shift.